one of them says that, you know, he says, we knew they were coming. He says, we knew. He said, after all, we have our people in their group and they have theirs and ours. And he says, each camp knows well, pretty well, what the other is planning and what's going on. I think that's true. So he says that the work is one to put a guard on my house. No, first let me get this right. He says that the workers wanted to put a guard in my house. But he says, I told them it wouldn't be necessary as long as I knew they were coming. So he says, I rewired the entire house so that the switches weren't where they, if anybody knew where they were, so they could come in and turn on the lights. And he pulled out his automatic 45 and laid it on the table and pulled out a drawer in his dresser and pulled a German Luger out laid alongside of him. He says, I had those boys with me, and if I do or say it myself, I can handle it. And he says, Margaret has been trained to slip in new clips. She says, if I'd been at home, she says, before they went to Little, he says, they went to my place. She says, from my place, they went to Smith's place. But he says, we were at a banquet. Oh yeah, that's when I said that you were lucky to be at a banquet that particular night. And that's when he pulled out his gun. He says, yes, I was lucky, but he says, I wasn't the only one. He says, if I'd been at home, he says, I'm quite sure, he says, my doorstep would have been very slippery the next morning. Can you imagine these guys, him cold-bloodedly preparing in the dark, in the house, and Margaret loading the guns and Bill sitting there and coming in through that door? They wouldn't have got Bill. Not that night, they wouldn't. And I'm sure this is the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a church basement, German church basement in Butte, did you know that?
No.
Oh yes, they had it rented, a German church basement. And I come in one day, went down there, and I said, you know, I got to thinking. That I said, it's an amazing thing that this church is still setting here. This is why. Because the Butte Bulletin is being published here. There's a lot of powder in Butte, isn't there? Yeah, there's a damn good reason, says one of them. I don't know why it's still here. I says, what is the reason? He says, 25 men with 25 rifles on guard every night, 24 sleeping and one on guard, awake. And he says, all of them ready to use it if need be. No, that's right. I come down there to this church, and Smith was there, Bill wasn't. And we got talking about something of this kind, the struggle that was going on. And he says, you know, I thought Bill's time had come the other night. I said, what happened? Oh, he says, the other morning. Oh, he says that a new stool pigeon come in. And he says, we knew him the minute he lit in Butte. Knew of him, you know. They had a trace of him. And he says, Bill, give him an editorial. The Butte Bulletin. And of course, Bill could write that kind of an editorial. And he says, the next morning, he storms in with his hands in his pocket. And he says, I'm looking for Bill Dunn. It's in the wintertime. And he says, Bill stepped up to him. He says, he rammed his hands into his pocket. And he says, I knew he had a gap in each hand. And he says, you could see them pointing at each other. And he says, I'm he, says Bill. Well, and he says, the other guy opened up on him, and he says, he was full of hops. He says, I'm sure of it. And he says, I moved out of line, so I wouldn't stop a bullet after going through Bill. And he says, I had my gun in my hand, you know, in his pocket. Mm-hmm. So he says, when the other guy lit up, he says, he read a terrific deal on Bill. With both of them standing covering each other, he says, Bill's kicked him on the shin. He said, you dirty son of a bitch. He kicked him a couple of times. Get the hell out of here. I believe it. I believe Bill just had that kind of guts. Knowing that he was pointing his gun at him, and maybe that's the only thing that kept him from shooting. Smith says he was all hopped up, and he perhaps was. But I just come back from Chicago to the United Front Conference in Chicago. And of course, that was quite a conference. I don't know whether you were there or not.
I wasn't there.
No, well, it was quite a conference. Big. There were sharecroppers from down south and people from all over the United States were there. And they had quite a program. So I was fairly well loaded. And I met my brother down there, and he says, "Well," he says, "Burdick and Lemke are going to speak down here at the auditorium." I said, "Let's go down and see what they have to say." He either didn't know it's a holiday association meeting called by Burdick. So we went down, and here neither Burdick nor Lemke were there. But a young farmer was carrying on, and he was doing a pretty good job. He says that they'd asked him to hold the meeting together till the heavy artillery consisting of Burdick and Lemke arrived. And he was doing a pretty good job of it. Then the two of them come, and Burdick is introduced, and he starts speaking, and he hands out the damnedest demagogy. So I got up. He hadn't spoken 5 minutes. I says, "Mr. Burdick," I says, "do you mean to tell us?" So, well, he was just furious, because this was later than that meeting in Bismarck, you know. That Bismarck didn't come first. You could see Burdick has a violent temper. And so he thought he'd put me on the spot. So he wound up by asking me. Well, they give me an opening, you know, and I stood right there, and I never pulled any punches in the least. It couldn't push me too far to the left, you know. And it wasn't long till they began to, they gave me a very nice hand, and they began to yell, "Take the floor, take the stage, take the stage." Well, I knew that Burdick was licked, because, you know, you hang back the louder the demand gets on something like that, and it did. It got stouter and stouter, till finally Burdick invited me to come up and take the stand. Well, I looked over at him, and I says, "Well," I says, "this puts me in a somewhat embarrassing position, Mr. Burdick." He was so mad he didn't even think what he was saying. He just barked at me, "You don't act embarrassed." Well, I says, "How much time shall I take?" Well, what could he say? He said, take what time you need, and he did. So I spoke for darn near an hour, reported on the conference down there, and I got a swell hand, you know what I mean. Burdick never spoke, neither did Lemke. That was the end of the meeting. Well, the next meeting was, then he was going to hold a meeting up in Trail County, up in Mayville. I wasn't a member of the holiday yet. And I said to myself, I says, "My God," I said, "I can't let that kind of demagogy get by in my home county." So I called Edwin Cooper up, and Ole Olson, Farmers Union, you know, he's Ole L. Olson, he's one of the state committee of the Farmers Union, and president or vice president of this grain company. So I told him I'd like to have him get some of their leading progressives and holiday men together. I'd like to come up and talk with them. So I did. And they did, and I come up. He invited me up for that evening. It's colder than the devil. And I drove up. I told him what had taken place down here, and I said, "I'm going to follow him to Mayville," and I says, "if he's going to hand out that kind of damn demagogy," I says, "I'm going to interrupt him." And I says, he knows it now, so he'll be prepared for me. And I says, "I'm not a member of the Holiday Association. I'd like to have you take my membership so that I'd be a member of the association." I says, "because he's going to try to kick me out, and I'm going to see if he can make it." So,
You really enjoy a fight.
Yes, they said they'd be glad to take my membership, you know. Mm-hmm. So they did. And I went up and I selected a spot about 4 or 5 seats back from the front row in the middle aisle. I think that's a pretty good position. And I waited for him. Burdick comes up. The very first thing he says, "How many of you are members of the Holiday Association?" Of course he knew I was not a shot man. And looked in his face and grinned, and you know, it absolutely floored him. I anticipated it, you see. It absolutely floored him. Well, he says, I'm glad to see there are so many of you. And then he gave a very decent speech, and he says, I see that Jasper Holland is here, and he says that there must be cooperation amongst the people that are carrying on this fight, and he says we must cooperate with Jasper Holland. And then he invited me to take the platform. Well, I thanked him very much and told him that it's so cold, it's so cold in there that I said, I'm not going to prolong the suffering on anybody. I said, it's too cold in here for a meeting. And I said, thank you very much. But I said, maybe we'll get together. At least I hope so. And that was that. But he didn't try to kick me out. He made a good speech. Bertie was capable and clever. I suppose he's too old now to be
influential. And that is that in our papers that we especially on the front pages of the Daily Worker, on the front page of the Worker, that it espouses issues particularly of national interest. There are still too many inner party problems discussed, and it's too sectional, in my opinion. But if particularly we could have on the first and second pages of the papers material that would interest the farmer and the worker in California, in Texas, Oklahoma, Detroit. They were engaged to go to Kuznetsk in Siberia and develop the mining industry in that part of the Soviet Union, and he had a number of IWWs with him. Now these IWWs, they were theoretical people, but they were not exactly practical workers. Very few of them had any experience in practical work in the mines or anywhere else. So they had difficulty in getting things started at Kuznetsk. I think it's Kuznetsk. I'm not absolutely sure about the ending of that name, but and then they started to have difficulties amongst themselves, differences of opinion about how they were going to go out and do this. And most of them were philosophers, and they were not economic realists. So they had difficulties along that line. So I think the Soviet Union, the Soviet government had to do certain things, you know, in order to straighten that out. And I think that some of the things they didn't really I didn't agree with the bill, and he left there, and they had found him wandering down by the Black Sea coast. I guess he, as I understand it, he was trying to find a boat that he could travel on to the USA. Or somewhere else. Well, then finally they did something about Bill Haywood. Somebody had told them that Now this is a rotten shame to have this man wandering around here sort of endlessly. So they engaged the room for him in the Lutz Hotel, which was usually a hotel for foreigners. And he had a very nice place there, and a big library, all kinds of books.
This and is his own?
Huh?
His own library? His own?
Well, it might have been. Might have been. I'm not so sure about that, but it could have been. Parts of it, anyway, was his own. I don't know just exactly how he left America.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he was able to take anything along or not. But he skipped, you know, skipped the bail. So that's where I found him. Someone had told me where he lived, and I thought I was going to call on him. So he had a big room, and he had a place where he could cook his own meals. And he had money, so he could buy whatever he wanted to get in the way of food and clothing. He was really well taken care of, and he was bragging and boasting about the particular local authorities in Moscow, about the treatment that he got. Very, very well satisfied. Now, whether this was a diplomatic approach he made or not, I couldn't say, but that's how he expressed it. And while I was there, he made up a ham and egg meal for me, and it was very good. And he cooked his own potatoes. He went to the restaurants, you know, to the stores and bought this stuff. Well, he wanted to be talking about what was going on in the United States, especially about the IWWs. Well, I told him that since the Russian Revolution, especially, there seemed to be a division in the IWW movement. Well, he understood that would be quite possible, and he was he didn't think that the party people in the United States were going at it in the wrong way, or in the right way. So he said that if the IWW could have gotten hold of the movement, then it would have prospered. So he had that line of thought that if only the IWW could become supreme in the Communist Party in the United States, well then it would be dead sure to go forward with great success. He told me the parting admonition that he gave me was that tell my friends over in the United States that they should do everything possible to get an upper hand in the Communist Party of the USA. He felt very much that would be the proper orientation. So he was after that at the Bolshoi Theater, where they were holding meetings, you know. This Negro that I had with me, he wasn't with me when I was at the Lux Hotel, but he was with me when we went to the Bolshevik meeting. So he, that was the first time that he had met Davis, and he was very much interested in Davis. After that, he lost all interest in me. He didn't want to have anything to do with me. He made a dive for Davis immediately. And he slapped him on the shoulder and he said he was glad to see him and all that. You know. In the USA, that they gained the upper hand so that the work of organization and education can go forward full blast. What he had learned on his trip to the Soviet Union and whether he was doing anything in the way of organizing his own people, giving them a picture of something that could be really looked forward to in a political and economic sense. And he just shook his head and wasn't anything to that. Educate Davis and prepare him for future work.
Mm-hmm.
In the Negro movement, but that seemed to be impossible, and I did all possible to do that, but there didn't seem to be any chance. And I didn't go at him very, very brusquely, very easily as good, and I told the other people that I got to work on him the same thing. We traveled a good deal. We traveled down to Kyiv. We came to Kyiv in just before, the day before May 1st. And on May 1st in Kyiv, we witnessed a very big parade. It's the first time in my life that I've ever seen a parade like that. And it really was amazing. You know, I was going to write about that too. Kyiv at that time had about a population of 450,000. And there were in this parade easily that many, 450,000, probably 500,000 in the parade.
Mm.
With the exception of old people and very small babies, you know, everybody was out. And Kyiv was supposed to be the most European city, one of the most European cities in the Soviet Union, and it had been taken and retaken in the imperialist war and in the counter-revolutionary wars 17 times taken and retaken, and the factories and other buildings, they were just dug full of holes, bullet holes, and chimneys were standing in empty. The factories hadn't been rebuilt yet. Terrible destruction. But despite this, they seemed to be very. And remember now that this was in 25, not so very far removed from from the ending of the counter-revolution in 1922. Still, they seem to be very happy and they look healthy. That surprised me very much. I imagine I would find plenty of sunken-in cheeks.
Mm.
No, they were round cheek and rosy cheek.
Mm.
I thought it was very wonderful. And before in the evening, before the parade, we got in there about 8 o'clock in the evening. We were at the big banquet. You know, you must remember that we were real celebrities.
You must remember.
Absolutely, real celebrities. So they had prepared a big banquet there for us, and all the leading citizens of Kyiv, they were at this banquet. And it took about 4 hours, I guess, before we were through. And there were a lot of speeches. I had to make some remarks, you know, and Davis had to say a few words too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tried to school him a little about just how he should handle himself, but he was a little bit afraid that I was steering him astray. He didn't have complete confidence in me. So he went pretty much his own way. Well, it didn't do much harm. So then in the morning, the parade, before it started, we drove out to the drilling grounds of the Red Army, just outside the city of Kyiv. And we watched the Red Army soldiers take the oath. There were, I don't know, there must have been about 45 or 50,000, I think, of these Red Army troops. And they were shooting their fists in the air, and they hollered emphatically when they took this oath, and the ground fairly shook.
Mm.
Yeah, I thought that was a very imposing sight.
Mm.
So after the ceremonies out there, then we drove back through the main street of Kyiv, and it was very difficult for our automobile to pass. We had two automobiles. There were about, I think, maybe about 12 delegates. There were delegates from the USA. There was one delegate from Mexico, and one from Bulgaria, and one from Yugoslavia. And we were in this, riding in these autos through the crowd. And the crowd was so thick that we had to go very slowly.
Mm.
And we had to stand up in the automobile and wave to the crowd all the time. Take our hats off. And they had all of our pictures right on the front page.
Mm.
You know, with our... I read my own name in Russian, in the Russian letters. The same with all the others.
Uh-huh.
And so the citizens of Kyiv, they knew that who we were. And we were really, we rode through the main street here just like conquerors. I think I've told Pat about these things before, I don't know. But this is at Kyiv, May 1st, 1925. As we drove through the crowd, you could see the vast concourse of people for about a mile and a half Anyway, across the whole street, there was no traffic going on.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only traffickers.
You were in the parade, or was this?
Yeah, we were. No, we were not in the parade, but this was while the paraders were lining up. This was just before the parade. So when we came to the where the reviewing stand was, we got out of our automobiles and then went up some steps they had built, constructed a platform there, and we were in the reviewing stand, you know, when the parade started. The parade started about 10 o'clock in the forenoon, and it kept on till 6 at night, 6 in the evening. That's 8 hours.
And were you taking off your hat and waving all that time?
They were marching 6 abreast on both sides of the street. They had to do that in order to get through with the parade. And on one side, on the opposite side of the viewing stand, was a chorus of 600.
Mm.
600 Ukrainian voices. And they were all standing up. They were not sitting down. They were all standing up, and I didn't see anyone sit down. I didn't see, of course, there might have been some who had done that, but no one left during all that time. They were just standing there. They were all interested in the parade. And the director, he was standing on a special platform and directing the chorus. The first who came in the parade were the little folks, the young pioneers, from 6 and up to 10 or 12 years of age. There were tens of thousands of these. They were all dressed alike, in the usually black dresses, and they had a red handkerchief around their necks. This symbol of the young pioneers.
Black
that,
and red.
Huh?
Black dresses.
Yeah, they were black dresses.
Mm.
Or there were variations now and then, but most of them were dressed in black. I don't know what the significance of that was. I don't think that it was connected with anything sorrowful or anything of the kind. Then followed the members of the Young Communist League, and there were thousands of those.
Mm.
Then came the teachers in the public schools. Then followed the workers in the factories of Kyiv and surrounding towns. There were various floats depicting the beginning of the economic construction in the USSR. There was one float, and the sign was very prominent: "Workers of the World Unite." This was a group of revolutionaries from other countries, including the United States. They had a special group in this parade. And developed the socialist society in the USSR. I told her, I said, "I'm amazed at the size of this parade." And I told them, "I haven't seen anything like this in my country, and I really believe that you are trying to fool us here." The paraders, when they come down here four or five blocks, then they turn and go around, and it's the the same players who come over and over. You know, and he said, no, he says, it's conservatively estimated that there are here in this parade between 450 and 500,000 people. The population of Kyiv was 450,000.
Yeah.
Well, now, as maybe I shouldn't make this confession, but the sun was hot. I had my hat off. The hat was continuously in the air, waving to the paraders. You know, and the mayor there, whoever he was, he would say, for example, when the young pioneers passed by, "Are you ready?" Well, the little folks, they held up their hands and said, "Always ready." And it actually worked on me in such a way that I had to leave the reviewing stand. I had to go to the town. I think it was about 4:30 o'clock then. So I didn't see the end of the parade, unfortunately, before it, too much of an extent. Yeah, it could have been that.
Did you drink any vodka?
Yes, oh yes, we had some. And that was some various kinds of this vodka.
Yeah.
But it's something like the moonshine that they used to have here North Dakota.
Exactly.
Newtown is now where it's flooded.
Oh, by the garrison?
That's where I left it.
When I drive up here, I'm
building of this minority that finally left the farmers, that educated them.
Say, I want to ask you, Pat, now, do you remember the First League State Convention in Fargo?
Mm-hmm.
Remember it?
Yes.
Were you there?
Yes.
You were there?
Mm-hmm. Not as a delegate.
No.
I was there with the mass.
But you were there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that's very interesting. I'm trying to...
Were you there?
Oh, yes. I was working in the league office.
Yeah, I thought you were.
What year was that?
That was in 16, the spring of 1916.
Yeah.
In Bismarck?
Fargo.
Oh, Fargo.
Fargo. Oh.
And I'm trying to find out all the people. Now, that's one thing you can help on that, who were there, and that you think were there, even though they might be dead now, see? And then I was trying to find out the date. I think it was in March, the latter part of March, when the state convention was held. The precinct meetings were on the 22nd of February, and then came the county conventions, which selected delegates to the state convention. But I can't remember the date when the state convention was held in Fargo. Now, of all people, I should know that, because I was right there.
Well, of course,
I don't remember.
Isn't that in Prairie Fires at all?
I don't know whether the political Prairie Fire mentions that or not.
I don't remember.
He's got a lot of details.
Do you remember that?
Set up the leader the year before? Yeah. Was that set up when we started organizing it?
Set up the year before.
Yeah.
It came out in the fall of 15.
Yeah, I thought so.
The leader.
You could probably...
I never was too often. I never went to Fargo too often after that. Yes, I know where it was.
Now there...
Not out of my territory.
What was your territory?
Well, the western part of the state.
Western.
Yeah, but I was wondering if you were in Fargo, you know, when you came to Fargo as a visitor, that you might have gone up to help.
Well, you see, I was at the last convention we held there in 1921, and we voted to discontinue Fargo on account of the reception we got. See, the Legion had thrown us out of the hall.
Oh, yeah.
And after that, there was no office there.
see, after 22, well, 22 it was, yeah. See.
But in the spring of 1916, then the office was there. Then later on it was moved to St. Paul.
Yeah, I remember that.
In that?
Up and down Broadway, a torchlight parade.
We were real respectable then, you know.
Yeah. They didn't know what you were up to yet.
No.
That's when an IVA spectator, you know, told one fellow who was especially enthusiastic about the nonpartisan league, carrying a sign, a wheel stick, wheel win sign, and he was hollering and shouting, you know, how far he was going to go. So this IVA spectator on the sidewalk, he asked him, "Where are you going?" "Oh, I'm going to Bismarck." "Oh, shucks," he says, "you won't get any farther than to Jamestown."
Was Arthur there? That
when after they moved the office to St. Paul, really found in other books of the league, and it's from the standpoint of the revolutionary farmers themselves and the organizers of the league, mm-hmm. the rank and file organizers of the league, who really built the organization.
Yeah.
Of course, Townley claims that he built it.
I thought we were building that elevator somewhere. Maybe you should shut that off when we decide something.
We can wipe it out, you know. Yeah. It's nothing final.
the fight started about 1910, I think. You know, the demand for an elevator. First they were going to build it in St. Paul.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Equity. And then, of course, we finally turned it over to the state here, wanted the state to take care of it.
Yeah.
And at this, at the legislature in 1914, I guess 14, 16, or 15 that would be, it was turned down. See, the farmers went down there and demanded that a law be passed authorizing the building of an elevator. That is for test purposes. And when that was turned down, then the campaign began, then, about 1915.
This was before, at that time, there was no
the
testing
equity
of the
fight
league?
Took place first, before the league. Oh. Then I don't know who got the idea about the league. Were you around then? I wasn't nowhere near where it was
organized.
I wasn't
around, but I think I know fairly well how it originated. I was in the Socialist Party,
yeah.
But I wasn't around here or any place where they were really active.
Were you a socialist then?
Yeah.
They had been discussing after what you had described there about the equity and so on. They were discussing within the Socialist Party to find a means of going ahead with the work in a faster way. That is, the Socialist Party became too slow for some people in the Socialist Party, even though it was going very fast at that time, in 1915. So this discussion took place amongst the members in the party, including I don't believe really that Townley even was a member of the Socialist Party.
No, I never thought so.
I don't think he was.
No.
But at any rate, he was interested to a degree anyway. So they discussed the thing, and it is really A.E. Bowen. A.E. Bowen. One of the principal league organizers and speakers who thought of this idea of a non-partisan league. Townley was not the originator of this, of the non-partisan league. This is what he is credited with being. But
well, it's hardly likely that one man ever thought of all of it anyway, did it? I mean, it was something
they
that
had
must
been
have
discussing this thing back and forth. E. Bowen and L.L. Griffith and Others, maybe Arthur was in on it. I don't know.
Dad Walker.
Dad Walker, yeah.
Dad Walker.
He was a prominent one. But at any rate, that's where it was. So when it comes, it came really to starting it, that's when Hungary comes in. He was always quick to catch something from somebody else. But he wasn't a man to originate things. He wasn't one who was able to analyze. He didn't possess an analytical mind. So he told Bowen, who had originated this idea, that he didn't think that he would be the one who could run this thing. That he was the one who should do it. And he was the dominating personality. Even though A.E. Bowen was no slow poker himself. Nevertheless, the Townley got sort of the upper hand in this the question of just how...
Well, here's another thing, too, that was a factor in it. Townley was a citizen of the state, and he had tried big farming, see, in the beach country. Went broke, you know, had all sorts of machinery and... was one of those promoters who tried to make money off other people. You know, he tried to farm too big for the time. Mm-hmm. He had many tractors and lots of machinery. And of course he went broke, see, and of course he was a little bit sore about his failure.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't work himself, of course, he wasn't in the habit of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course since he was a farmer, and since Bowen, you know, was just an agitator in Minnesota, you know, he was the best of the two. He was a real organizer, Bowen. And I think that's part of the reason why it came about that Tommy was selected.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
Being a farmer,
yeah.
So-called.
Well, was he actually selected by the...
Well, no. They started organizing it. They got a few Ford cars, see,
mm-hmm.
and began to... they laid some plans. I wasn't there. These plans were laid. You know anything about who laid the plans to get out memberships and so on?
Oh, yes, they were. They were. This was discussed in the group.
Yes.
Yeah.
And where did they meet? I wasn't with them. At Beach or Bismarck?
Yeah, they might have met in Beach, and they might have met at Bowman and Hettinger.
Yeah.
It
started down there in the southwest corner.
Yeah, in the southwest corner of the state. The league started, they started to organize there.
Yes, I remember. And then it came up through McKinsey County, my county. I was young then, kind of. I didn't have any roots, you know, with farmers. I was a farm worker,
yeah.
You know, more or less. You know, I didn't have any land and was young. But I did fall into this. I was interested in the Socialist Party and the IWW.
Did you belong to the IWW then?
Two at times, yeah. But then, of course, they as soon as the thing was, they got authorization for it. Townley pushed it then, and everybody did. And of course, it spread like wildfire. You know, there seemed to be no trick at all to get farmers to. Well, this is after this other thing took place, you know, where they told us to go home and slop the piggies.
Mm-hmm.
At Bismarck, remember, they went down to the legislature. Loftus was there. First, the equity people were fighting this first, doing the agitating, as I understood it. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Loftus.
Yeah.
Well, I thought we ought to organize. I figured we'd organize this thing, you know, before we start talking about it, you know. And,
well, that's all right. We've got plenty of time.
He came up there and took the hide off one of the legislators who voted against this. He was a very good speaker, very good organizer, George Loftus.
Yeah.
And he must have a place in this because he was very honest and sincere about this thing. And I remember that I liked it very well. They had a big meeting there and he called this legislator up, a representative from Divide County, and just tore his hide off about how he had voted, you know, against the farmers and the elevator bill. And from there it started.
Well, what was the main beef then? It was the wheat.
Price of the wheat.
Prices
and the interest.
And the interest and the weight,
yes.
And all of that.
Dockage and how they were dealing at the elevators. See,
there was no warehouse commissioner, anything.
No,
to
no, nothing.
No control of
nowhere.
Anything.
Yeah, that's right. What we wanted was something where they could find out what's in the wheat. See, that's why the North Dakota elevator paid off really down here.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't make so much profit, but it did find out what was what.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions were ideal for getting the Nonpartisan League underway.
But that was the basic
trouble,
the wheat.
The objective situation was very favorable.
That's true.
Here was the equity that Pat has been telling about here, who sort of laid some of the groundwork mm-hmm. for the league, mm-hmm. and then the condition existing at that time that has been mentioned about prices and cheating at the elevators. And
was Dr. Ladd active in the equity? Did he come in later? Ladd, who from
he came in
agricultural
later.
School.
But he furnished lots of material through his office there. Yeah.
That's what I thought, yeah. Even in this early
time.
That's
right.
Well, that sounds logical. It should start there. But then their failure to get any response from the legislature, was that what
that was really the thing that sparked it off?
Uh-huh.
And and of course that Twitchell said, you know, he didn't say it, but he was the said, go home and slap the hogs where you belong.
Uh-huh.
To the farmers, a large delegation there, and of course the result was this.
Did he really say that?
Well, he claims he didn't, but they say he did. And I think he did. He had contempt for the farmers anyway. Yeah.
He didn't he intended to.
It's like the sinking of the Maine. We a few of the Spaniards didn't do it, but and of course from there it started. And old hell wouldn't stop it. Claimants, you know, for joining it. Here was a chance to get in the puddle, you know, get something going. And it was a good idea.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, everywhere in all the, wherever there were groups of socialists, that's where they could put the organization over. It's one of the first socialist speakers I ever heard. A. Bowen.
I see his reports of his speeches.
Oh, yes. He was very good. Very good speaker. A very good organizer. He had a good knowledge of Marx. Socialism. I heard a debate, with him.
Do you think, Pat, that the nonpartisan league could have been built if he hadn't had these socialist organizers?
No, I don't think so.
It's very, I'm making the statement that it's very doubtful.
It could be said
that
it
could have been started.
No.
Or the education
without
that they had
these, without these forces
uh-huh.
showing the need for expert and intelligent organizers to conduct things,
yes.
To get things.
Well, another thing went down, you know, as soon as the organization was set up and they began to send out literature, it was went with the membership. Pearson's magazine went. That was socialist magazine at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And every farmer knew it. Joined.
Pearson's?
Yes. Was it Pearson's?
Pearson's magazine.
Pearson's magazine.
Yeah, that's right.
Where was that? Pearson's. That's not Harris's magazine.
That was published in...
not Frank Harris's Pearson's.
Was it New York?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
You mean it was Frank Harris the editor?
Well, I don't remember who.
Yes,
well, that's the thing that brought their political level up a little higher, the rank and file, see? We socialists thought they should have something like that.
Was it a socialist?
Socialist magazine.
Wasn't Charles Edward Russell connected with that?
I think
Charles
so.
Well, that's the Russell I was trying to
ask Charles
about
Edward,
the other
That's right.
If you read
magazine.
His book.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the farmers, the non-socialist farmers, took to this magazine. They began to read it.
I have to go and look at that. You can look up the... find some files
in
that.
You would find that in the historical
I think so.
Society in St. Paul.
I think so. I bet they would.
Well, then they set up small organizers anywhere. That's what I become at first, as an organizer in the township. You know, township organization was set up. It became almost thorough.
When did I first meet you, Pat?
Oh, I don't know, sometime in Bismarck. I don't know just when. Back about the 20s.
I can't remember exactly.
I don't either.
Yeah, it might have been this one.
Well, I think that we had
circulated among a few, see? And then there were, it seems there were quite a few lecturers that started out. Beecher Moore, A. Bowen, Thomason. They'd make tours of this country, and it really seems they always had good audiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though the people who didn't belong to the Socialist Party.
They came.
Yeah, they'd come to hear it. And they sometimes have debates with ministers, preachers, you know.
Yeah. So I was reading here.
And from that, and then they did, they were good agitators and good organizers. All those people, Moore and Bowen and Thomason, very good speakers and very radical. The city where I was raised, there we had a debate with the, there was a farmer there named Malloy that undertook to debate this Bowen, and he had to make another trip back. And of course, all of Malloy done was abuse him, you know, and it seems that he took sides again the Mexican people. There was a revolution in Mexico at that time, an uprising. And anywhere they went, they had an audience. And of course, the Wobbly would speak everywhere to the farmer. He had a lot to do with it, you know.
Yeah,
working men
mm-hmm.
that come out here with their stuff and had their literature here and talk to the farmers. First thing they tried to do was educate the farmer and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, North Dakota, I think, got its share of this from these people.
It was
Mexican people. There were a few of the Germans that were socialists, you know. But there weren't so many of the Scandinavians who were socialists. They were mostly farmers from the old country. But it just grew up. Of course, the Norwegians proved to be the easiest people to organize.
But they were Lutherans like Minnesota. I still can't understand.
But they weren't. They're a nice people.
They
first, they'd be.
They should have been the toughest.
They weren't.
Well, in Minnesota, they are.
Are they?
Yeah, the most reactionary.
Well, they weren't a generation ago. I mean a generation ago, the old country people. They were nice, you know, and hospitable, and they'd give you a hearing, see, was the idea. They weren't smart about it. They would listen. And, of course, most of them in the league, they were, the best leaguers were Norwegians, and the main men, more Norwegians than all the rest of them combined.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make any difference. They didn't vote for a Norwegian. The politicians used to say, well, now wait till we run somebody. That's why they run Nestus once, remember? The Norwegians would all flock to him. Well, he got in, barely, but they had run many Norwegians before, and they didn't get in.
Oh,
Norwegians stayed on his own side, the majority of them. That's what good socialist understanding will do.
Well, I think it's a phenomenon how it developed here. When you realize this was a frontier town, and then you read on this newspaper here.
Come to see Debs up there when he was at Williston.
Yeah.
The country was just full of people.
Debs was here.
Yes.
Were you there?
Yes, at Williston.
At Williston.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where did he speak? In the town? Or?
No, out on the fairgrounds.
Out in the fairgrounds.
Country fairgrounds.
In the country.
Yeah.
Well, that's
brilliant.
Huh?
Your book.
What was the date?
I don't remember the date.
He was through here in 1911.
No, I've
either 10 or 11.
To find out. Ben Husset, he knows the date, Ben Husset.
Another thing.
Ben
would know.
1913.
No, I think it's earlier than that.
I was looking at the 19.
I knew it. I'm quite positive it wasn't. It wasn't before 1912 anyway. I know that.
Yeah.
But that was the year that I joined the Socialist Party,
oh.
And there hadn't been any meeting.
Oh yeah, after that maybe.
And I figured that it was the next year that the meeting was held in Williston. But I might be mistaken.
Right? Oxen even out in McKenzie County.
Yeah.
Buggies and wagons.
Well, do they, did
an
they,
old car once in a
did
while.
Did they give any account of how this thing started there in the microfilm?
Well, it just gets at that time.
Yeah. That was about the time.
Were you there?
I was at Concordia.
Oh, you were going to Concordia.
Yeah.
Well, I think it must have been roots of the Socialist Party here as early as when it began.
1905 is
1905.
The first time I know about
uh-huh.
it. I heard these lectures. I more or less belong to it since. I think I became a member in 1909. That is for sure. I used to follow it before that.
But you see, there was all that seed was planted from then on, from 1905. And the IWW was organized in 1905.
Yeah.
Cool.
They'd be out here in the harvest fields. I had a lot to do with them because I used to work at that. Used to run steam engines and repair machinery. That was my trade for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So the Wobbly, I encountered them, these harvester workers from many places.
Well, tell us about them. Is that early?
Well, I never was on a rig where they had complete control, where they could organize it, but they'd use their influence to create better conditions, shorter hours. Well, make it more humane, you know. The
mm-hmm.
farmer would work you all night. And then he wouldn't be satisfied.
You were kind of in between.
Yeah, I was
between the farmer and the, and the IWW.
Yeah. And, of course, they were always agitating and had literature, and I would say they had a lot to do with waking the farmer up. You know, where They didn't do all these things that they were alleged to have, you know, like putting stones in the bundles and blowing up threshing machines.
Oh, you mean the idea of a devil?
Yeah, that happened very often with rival machines or smart fellas that were doing it, you know, and blame it on them.
Sure.
And
so but their education was wonderful,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Material that they mm-hmm. had, the pamphlets.
Yeah.
And
and what impressed you most was the high organizational ability among them. They were smart and well posted on mm-hmm. this thing.
Well, you know, I used to go to their school in Kansas City, you know. They used to have a winter school there. That's where they got educated, those winter schools they used to have. Save their money, and
yes.
And the Browder brothers were down there then when in Kansas City, and Foster. Yes. And
that's right.
I attended my first lecture there on when I was about 10 years old.
Oh, yeah.
On value, price, and profit.
Yeah. When you were an organizer, you carried the riggin.
The what?
The riggin.
What's that?
That's the organizational equipment.
Oh, I
the
see.
Books.
Like the riggin.
Yeah.
What do you call that?
The riggin. He carries the riggin. To be an organizer.
He had his pamphlets? And
yeah. And the application.
The preamble.
Yeah.
I met an IWW in San Francisco who could recite all the preambles to the Constitution since 1905.
Yeah.
By heart. And I think the IWW had the most advanced cultural education that anyone has had since. I mean, people weren't ashamed to write poetry or short stories. Or, I mean, they had no respect for any story that didn't come from a worker. This IWW I talked to for a day and a night practically, he says, well, he says, you're pretty good for a woman and a non-worker. I said, what do you mean a non-worker? I said, I bet I raised more children than you did. No, they had a great culture, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to make a compilation of the poetry in the old IWW journals and the satires. And everybody wrote poetry.
Yeah, while you're on that, now, this is something I was going to tell you. We had a poet here in the League days named Mrs. Bonner. Is that one of her books?
No.
You remember Mrs. Bonner? She wrote poems.
No.
You know the right kind? Huh?
Yeah.
Mrs. Bonner, see if you can find her book anywhere. I had one once. My wife got one, in fact, for making the slogan for the women.
Oh.
She won by Wheel Stick 2 for the women.
Wheel men, Stick 2?
Wheel Stick was the men, you know, and the women said Wheel Stick 2. And she
you
got
remember
the,
her first name? Bonner.
Florence Bonner.
Florence?
Florence Bonner. I don't know where she lived. I'm not sure now.
You think she's still alive?
No, I don't know. I hadn't heard of her in years.
I remember the name.
Remember? Yeah, she had a very, well, they were good poems.
I'll have to look that
yeah.
up. I suppose that they appeared
in the Leader at times, some of them, yeah. She had a book. There's quite a book of her poems.
Isn't it a shame we don't have a...
There was another character here who wrote some stuff on North Dakota. His name was Foley, I think. Do you know anything about him?
Foley?
Yeah. Inquire.